Good morning. It's 11:23 right here on KAJO Radio in Grants Pass, Oregon. I'm Chuck Benson, and we have a special talk segment here, and welcome to the microphones of KAJO. Our U.S. Congressman Cliff Bentz has joined us today. And Congressman, it's good to have you back in Southern Oregon again, and I bet it's kind of a relief to be out of the Washington, D.C. Area for a moment or two.
You are absolutely right, and so wonderful to have the opportunity to join you this morning.
All right. What's your schedule here real briefly while you're in Southern Oregon? Where have you been or where are you going and when will you be back?
Well, we've spent the last 3 days in the Medford area and got to go all over different places to one of the high schools and talk to one of the classes there, and then with the Chamber of Commerce down in Medford, and then with the Rotary Club, and then out to the landfill, and then to Jacksonville, and all over. And I'm very, very happy to get back here. We've been locked up in Washington, D.C. To your point about being happy to be here, I am. It's a huge relief to be out of the city and the friendly confines of Southern Oregon.
All right. And when do you go back?
I go back on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that's a day early, actually. The fly-in day is actually Monday, and then we vote Monday night. It's the way the scheduling works out. I'll go back on Sunday.
You have a very busy week coming up next week, as I understand it.
A very busy week. We have I'm not on the committee, the Mayorkas impeachment subcommittee. Mm-hmm. It's not really called that. It's the oversight subcommittee, but it's working on the Mayorkas impeachment. That's coming up on the 30th, I believe. And then
I know there's a vote coming up on Wednesday.
Yes, a vote's coming up. The other issues, tax related issues, there's a tax bill, I think, that might be coming up. And then there's much discussion right now about whatever it was that the Senate put together on the border. And so, I think it's highly unlikely that whatever they put together on the Senate is going to gain any traction in the House. And so, lots of issues going on in addition to that.
Well, it's a presidential year, so there are lots of issues flying around, and it appears that immigration has gone to the very, very top of the list. Did I understand you that you are not going to be involved in that hearing with Mayorkas?
We're peripherally involved. I'm on the Judiciary Committee.
Correct.
And normally all matters impeachment would be going through that committee. But in this case, the issue of the Secretary Mayorkas has been pushed over to the Homeland Security Oversight Committee. And so that committee has been handling the investigation into what he has been doing and ultimately the crafting of the articles of impeachment. So that's the committee, Homeland Oversight, that will actually vote at the committee level on the impeachment or not, or if Secretary Mayorkas. I anticipate that they will vote yes, and that the articles in correct form will make their way to the floor of the House. That would be my informed opinion right now.
And it would take just a majority to impeach Mr. Mayorkas?
Correct.
Okay. With that being said, that just means he's out of a job, correct?
Actually, and thank you so much for asking. No, the impeachment should be called the indictment. An impeachment in the House is merely an indictment. It does not convict him. The conviction, if it happens, would have to occur after a trial, and that trial is held in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So the reason it's so important that you have the impeachment articles in correct form is because it's the foundation then of the trial in the Senate. So if the House votes to impeach, that merely means that Secretary Mayorkas has been indicted, if you will, and then that matter goes over, that set of articles goes to the Senate, and then they decide, or the Senate decides, if it's going to take up the matter, and if it's going to hold a trial, and if it's going to actually vote on the impeachment / indictment. And it seems to me that in all probability, given that the Senate is controlled by the Democrats, that they may not take it up at all. Who knows? But we want to rob them of any excuse. That's why having the articles in appropriate form is so important.
Nice. Should the long shot happen and he be impeached in the Senate trial, what would happen to him then? Is he just out of a job?
He's removed.
He's removed.
He's out.
And I understand this, wanting to hold people's feet to the fire here, but should he be removed from the job, who will replace him? And that will be an appointment from the president.
Absolutely.
So would anything change?
I doubt it. But what's the idea, of course, when you do something so serious as an impeachment, first of all, you've got to be very, very, very cognizant of the fact that whatever you do, it's going to come back to haunt you if you go into the minority. Mm-hmm. So you better do it right, because it's an extraordinarily serious matter. If we do impeach him in the House and then the matter goes to the Senate and they don't act, it's a huge political issue, because it means that the Senate is ignoring his, the Secretary's failures on the border. Now, I will tell you, in the history of the United States, only one other cabinet member has been impeached. Only one in the entire history of the United States. And that means that you have to find something that the Secretary has done that has violated a law and rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors.
All right. Thank you very much, Congressman. I've got a time crunch right here. We'll be right back.
It's time.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to KAJO AM 1270. I'm not sure why the news cut off early. In the meantime, though, we're going to continue here. Just a brief word about the weather. It's overcast, rainy, and 47 degrees here to cover that situation. Now, Congressman Cliff Bentz has joined us here in our studios today, and I want to thank him very much for his busy schedule, taking time out to talk to the constituents here in Southern Oregon. And, Congressman, we've been talking about the impending impeachment of the Mayorkas. So let's move on just a little bit right now and talk about the House has been kicking down the road a spending bill to keep the government open. So you've got a couple of options. You can fund it for the full year, or are we playing politics here, trying to get something for nothing? Or or could we just shut it down, and what would happen?
Shut it down. Well, let me express something and make it really, really clear. I am totally in support of securing our border. And in fact, I've been down to the border now four times. As recently as 4 weeks ago, I went down with now Speaker Mike Johnson, who, by the way, is a good friend. He and I served 3 years together on the Judiciary Committee. So I was just down to the border. And the challenge there is incredibly difficult. But we in some fashion, we have to stop the incredible flow of migrants into the United States over our borders. The numbers are absolutely shocking. There about 300,000 people came across the border into the United States in December alone. And so the numbers are amazing. And so and I could go on for a week. The bottom line is, we need to do something about the border. Now, it has been suggested that we use the power of the purse to shut down the government and force the Democrats or the president or both to come to the table and do something about the border. That technique needs to be understood, because many people will say, sure, let's shut down the government. Excuse me. You have to understand that when you shut down the government, a lot of things stop. For example, no longer would we be paying our military. So that means the folks that are trying to defend the United States will still be working as soldiers and sailors and airmen and women, and but they won't be getting paid. And so they eventually, when we reopen the government, they would get reimbursed. They always have been. But during that period of time that the government is closed, they don't get paid. And so that means, I'm guessing, that they don't have big piles of money in their banks. They would put everything on a credit card. Now, when they finally do get their money, they don't get reimbursed for the interest they pay on those kind of things. And so that's one of the things that happens when you shut down the government. Now, let me just say, we enjoy a majority of about 5 votes in the House, about 5, about 217 of we Republicans, as compared to about 213-14 of the Democrats. And so if we want to do anything, we have to have 216 votes, where there's 217 of us. And so that means we have to have almost total agreement. We can have one person disagree with us out of 217. If you close down the government, then and you better have a plan to reopen it, because to reopen it would take the same 216 votes. And that means if you just two people can say, well, you know, I don't think we've gotten enough yet out of the Democrats or out of the president. Let's just keep the government closed. So if you're going to use that tool, you have to have a couple of things that we have never agreed on. One is, What do we need in order to reopen it? And have we all agreed on that? And that has not happened. That discussion hasn't even happened. I know because I attend everyone religious. I attend every one of the meetings of our Republican conference. All 217 of us are, it has varied. We had as many as 222 for a while. But right now, the challenge is if we're going to use that tool of closing down the government, first we have to have an agreement on how we're going to reopen it, because we can't just sit there and let the military not get paid for years, let the TSA folks that you have to go through at the airport suddenly not be there and you can't fly anywhere. There's many things that happen, and President Biden would be in charge of deciding who gets to suffer in the event that the government is shut down. And I guarantee you he would focus that suffering on red states. So what I'm saying is I'm sure as we approach March 1st, which is the date to which the continuing resolution funds the government, we will be having exactly this conversation. And in fact, I directed my staff to make arrangements for me to speak to the speaker's office the moment we get back about this exact issue. So I'll just say, closing down the government sounds good, but there are a lot of moving parts and they need to be resolved before we actually do that.
What would the Republican caucus need to receive in order to not shut down the government?
There's wide disagreement over that. Some would say they simply want the parole rule that allows many people to come in that shouldn't, or the asylum rule to be changed. Others want all of H.R. 2, which was the bill I've got an amendment into it that addresses eight different elements of immigration and would, I think, take a huge step towards securing the border. By the way, the president today, if he so chose, could sign an executive order saying that those who come to the border and might be entitled to asylum or parole have to remain in Mexico until that determination is made. If he signed an executive order saying that, it would reduce immigration by 70%. 70%. Yet he will not sign that order. H.R. 2 has remained in Mexico in it. And so if some people would say, before we would reopen the government, we must have the Democrats agree to H.R. 2. Well, they're not going to agree to H.R. 2. I guarantee it. They're not. And they would simply sit there and outwait us. They would sit there, the Democrats, and they would say, well, you guys close the government and we're not going to give in to your blackmail or extortion or whatever you want to call it. We're just going to sit here and watch you take the heat for all of the damage your shutdown is doing. And so these are the kind of conversations that have been ongoing among we Republicans and will continue this coming week. We'll try to get to an agreement on what we would have to have in return for reopening the government. We have not reached that agreement yet.
All right. How solid is the Republican caucus right now? One or two votes and you're gone. Is there a chance to get unification with the Republican caucus?
Well, it's been pretty tough to this point.
Yeah.
And you saw it. It took 15 votes to get McCarthy elected a year ago, and it only took frankly, it only took five votes to get rid of him. Eight people voted that way. But at the time, I didn't vote for removing McCarthy, but others did. Eight Republicans and all the Democrats. So the short answer is there is a huge split in the Republicans, and more than one split we have. And it's predictable. The many of the Republicans are from conservative states, and others are from less conservative states. For example, the Republicans from New York, that's a very liberal state. And so when they look at what needs to happen, it's quite different than that which someone from, South Carolina, a more conservative state, or Arkansas, or you name it, any red state. So the bottom line is, your question was, are we together? The sad answer is, not as much as I wish we were.
Are you taking pressure from the constituents? Are your cohorts in the Republican Congress getting resistance from their constituents saying, why can't the Republicans come together?
Oh, my goodness, yes. The ones I think that everybody has, well, the great thing about America, you're entitled to your own opinion. And nowadays, given social media and everything else, there's all kinds of ways of sharing it. And so there are many, many people who are saying, well, why in the world are you doing this? Or why in the world? Yes, there are many, many people weighing in and saying, for goodness sakes, Republicans, get your act together. I'll just tell you, having sat through literally hours, if not hundreds of hours now, of conference meetings. It's a real challenge. There are certain people who think that any type of compromise is anti-Republican, any kind. And so they will camp out on a position that they will never move. And those positions may be totally contrary to someone else's constituency that is also a Republican. And that makes it very, very difficult to get everybody together.
Right. Are you familiar with what the Senate is negotiating for the bill to fix immigration in the Senate right now? The president keeps saying, give me the money. What's that money going for? Probably not to close the border, as I understand it.
Right. So the bill that has been negotiated, I'm not sure anyone has seen it.
Like I said, nobody has really seen anything in print.
Right. There's been rumors. One of the rumors was that a part of the bill put a lid on the number of immigrants coming in to the country each day. That lid, the rumor has it, is 5,000 people a day. Well, I don't support that. That we don't want the lid to be 5,000 people a day. It actually was probably twice that during December, more like 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people a day. So the Democrats are trying to argue, well, if we just cut that in half, it'll only be, in quotes, only be five. No, that's not going to work for me or most Republicans. If that's in the Democrats' bill, the Senate's bill, that is not going to fly. There's certain people have been saying it's President Trump, who, by the way, I endorsed, but President Trump, who is directing we in the House on our position. That is not true. He certainly hasn't spoken to me about the border. He did call me, by the way, to thank me for my endorsement. And that was very nice of him. And he thanked me four times. He's very gracious. And that was in the first, I think, January 3rd. And but he certainly hasn't called me on the border. So this argument that somehow former President Trump is directing things is incorrect, at least in my experience.
Right. We've heard over the national news that if they were just enforced the rules as they are now on the border, it would fix the situation. So we're not enforcing the laws that we have on the books right now on the border. And does that go back to Mayorkas? Or does that go right to the top with President Biden?
Well, I think it's President Biden. I think it's, this is one of the reasons only one member of the cabinet has been impeached in the past history of the United States, because it's the president who directs the cabinet, and generally speaking, the secretaries of whatever, in this case Homeland Security, can point at the president and say, "I'm just following orders." But your question is, are there laws that are not being enforced? And I think the answer is yes. But what you would get from the other side of the aisle is, no, this is a policy call, not a law. The law that we're talking about would be the law that says if you don't have a place to come in and be held in the United States, you need to stay in the other country, Mexico, for example. The Democrats have made a policy call that they're going to let people come into the United States and await their hearing on asylum, for example. Those hearings are 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 years out. And so that makes zero sense. Is it illegal? Some would argue yes, some would argue no. And I would argue yes, but it's a close call.
All right. Moving on from the border crisis, because as well, obviously there's a lot going on there. Coming up is the disposition of Hunter Biden before the House. Is it a subcommittee or the entire Judiciary Committee?
So it's two committees. It's one is the Homeland Security Committee, mm-hmm. and the other is my committee, the Judiciary. And he was subpoenaed to appear before both. So we held hearings at the same time in our two committees on holding Hunter Biden in contempt. And I spoke at length. I generally don't, but I understand how subpoenas work. I'm a lawyer. I've issued a lot of them. And so it seemed to me that Hunter Biden had no excuse for not appearing for his deposition. And I made that as clear as I possibly could in that hearing. We voted unanimously as Republicans in the Judiciary Committee to hold Hunter Biden in contempt for not appearing for his deposition. I believe the same thing occurred in the concurrent hearing. Hunter Biden actually appeared in the other hearing. He actually came into the room and sat there and just to kind of rub everybody's nose in his contempt.
That was after his publicity stunt where he showed up on the Senate side and just held a press conference.
That's exactly right. He showed up outdoors with some of the Democrats with him. Yeah, that kind of thumbing your nose at Congress is should not ever be allowed, and he should be held in contempt, and I said that. This gave us an opportunity to call out, because this is an investigation into whether or not the president should be impeached, an impeachment inquiry, what in the world Hunter Biden was selling, because he's obviously peddling influence. Well, who's he influencing? Why would people pay him money, millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars, to influence someone? If the only person that I can imagine he's being paid to influence would be his father. And so the that kind of discussion occurred over the 6 hours we held in determining ultimately to hold him in contempt.
Do you foresee any ramifications for Hunter Biden being in contempt? Obviously, he's in contempt of Congress. Are there ramifications for that?
Yes.
And that can they be enforced?
Yes. Well, they can be enforced in a couple of different ways. The one that you generally rely upon is once he's held in contempt, then, of course, the Attorney General is supposed to bring an action for jail time. And that just happened. That just happened to a person whose name escapes me for the moment, but he was on the Republican side of the aisle.
He was one of Trump's men.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So no surprise that the Attorney General would go after one of Trump's people.
I think he got 4 months.
He got 4 months for disobeying a subpoena. I will just say that the odds of the Attorney General going after Hunter Biden are modest. They're low, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, low.
All right. No question about that. Let's move on just a little bit. You have many, many responsibilities in Washington, D.C. Tell me about your upcoming Wolves hearing.
So Wolves, my subcommittee that I have the privilege of being chair is water, wildlife, and fisheries. And that wildlife under that label are wolves. Wolves have been reintroduced here in Oregon, and I think maybe starting to appear actually here, Grants Pass. But we certainly have them out in the eastern part of the state, where my brothers still run cattle and have wolves coming into their cattle herds. I've not heard that my family's lost any calves, but friends of mine up in the John Day area in Grant County, I think, lost 29 calves to wolves in the past couple of months. That kind of loss should be borne by those who want to reintroduce these kind of creatures into civilization now, because that's what they're doing. The same type of issue, by the way, comes up with grizzly bears in other states, and where folks want to bring these animals back, even though things have changed pretty dramatically on the ground. The my hearing, the focus of it, sometime in late February, early March, in Washington, D.C., will be to give those who are affected by wolves and the damage they do an opportunity to speak up. But the main goal is to say, look, if people in L.A. and Chicago and New York and wherever want to have these creatures reintroduced, then they need to bear the cost. And the same is true for right around here with timber. If folks want to keep us out of the woods and just allow it just to burn up, then somehow they need to be bearing part of the cost of this ridiculous type of policy. And that's what I'm hoping to do in this hearing.
Right. All right, Congressman, you brought up timber, and that raises a lot of eyebrows here in Southern Oregon. This is a very, very poor county, used to rely on timber receipts significantly, and could again rely on a lot of that, because the BLM and the Forest Service is just not cutting the amount of timber, according to my information, that the plan says they should be cutting, and they're just cutting a fraction of that. What can be done about that? Are you familiar with that situation, and can you help?
I'm extremely familiar with the situation. And one of the reasons I endorsed Donald Trump for president is because he will do something about it. He will help us get back into the woods. And not only for the purpose of trying to remove some of the stuff that otherwise is going to burn up and fill your valleys here with smoke, but also to actually take some of the wood out and make money with it, which is something we used to do as a matter of course. So that if we have a Republican president, then I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get back into the woods in an aggressive way that will allow not only removal of all of this fuel, a bunch of it, but also timber for logging purposes. I'll just say I had the great opportunity. I was asked to lead, be the top person signing an amicus brief to the United States Supreme Court addressing the incorrect expansion of a monument by President Biden over some ONC land. And that's that ONC land, Congress said, is supposed to be used for multiple purposes, one of which is timber and logging. And yet the president went in with a stroke of a pen, said, well, we're going to put a monument over some thousands, tens of thousands of acres of land that had already been designated as therefore multiple use, including logging. So I have an amicus brief I was asked to lead, and it's pending now before the Supreme Court. And we're waiting to see if they're going to hear the case, which would determine, does the president have the power to override with Antiquities Act, the act you use to establish monuments, that which we Congress people have already said should be used for some other purpose. And I'm very happy to be leading that amicus brief, and we're very hopeful that the Supreme Court will take it up and say, no, the separation of powers does not allow the president to come in and say, oh, I'm sorry, Congress, you're out of luck. I'm going to put this land into a monument and no longer will it be used for multiple purposes.
Do you have any reading from the Supreme Court if they will take that up, and if so, when?
Well, no reading other than I think the Supreme Court right now is probably
a little busy.
it's a little busy, but the good news is I think it has people that understand the value of what Congress does and the need to make sure that the president can't run over us roughshod as he's done trying to make a monument over the clear objections of Congress.
With the loss of the timber revenues, the local counties, all the local communities have come to rely on PILT, the payment in lieu of taxes, and SRS funding for all the ONC counties. But those funds continue to dwindle on an annual basis. What's the future for those funds? Are they going away completely? What can the counties count on?
Well, I support both of those types of, I'm going to call them reimbursements to the county, because the counties have to take shoulder responsibility for all the activity on all of that federal land, and yet we're being precluded from actually taking timber or otherwise utilize those lands for purposes of generating income. It's a ridiculous situation. Of course we should be logging that land for all the obvious reasons to anybody that lives here in this community. But instead we're left going to Congress with a tin cup and begging for these monies to try to take care of the very land that environmentalists and other interests are allowing to burn up. It's ridiculous. And so the challenge for us is to make sure we keep getting that money until we change things and get back to policies that allow us to reduce the fire hazard and manage our forests appropriately.
Take our own fate into our own hands.
While at the same time, we have all the techniques and ability now to enter into the forest correctly, logically, rationally, environmentally, positively, and yet we're precluded from doing so for reasons that are, for the most part, ridiculous.
Congressman, you also oversee, and I don't have the right numbers in front of me, that committee on animals and water. And I understand the Grants Pass Irrigation District has a situation with their electricity here on the pumps. Are you familiar with that?
Vaguely. I think the problem is the cost of the electricity is really high. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I've not been brought up to speed on exactly where we are, so share with me where we are. I'm happy to try to work on the issue.
Well, from what I understand, and I am far from an expert on this, that the machinery installed by the federal government to when the dam came out doesn't match what needs to be done in terms of the electrical power, whether it's 220 or 110, and I'm certainly not an electrician, but that's been real briefly how it was explained to me, and the federal government right now is taking hands off.
Hmm. Well, I'll raise the issue when I speak with the county commissioners, which I think will be happening sometime today, and with your local state folks. And once I understand the issue, we'll see what we can do to help.
All right. Well, we certainly appreciate that. You have goals coming up for this Congress here. What would you like to see happen besides funding the government and closing the border?
Right. Well, the biggest challenge right now is for us to figure out how to get to an agreement on the top line number on discretionary spending. That's about $1.6 trillion. And there's a disagreement in my conference over exactly what that number should be. In the great scheme of things, the disagreement is very modest, and we need to get to an agreement. It's complicated. I won't go into the details of why it's so hard to go to where some people want us to go, which is slightly lower, having already reached an agreement for a higher number way back almost a year ago. So my goal is to try to help get to an agreement among we Republicans so we can then, having agreed on that top line, about $1.6 trillion number for discretionary spending, we can move forward with the 12 appropriation bills that need to be passed. We already agreed on 7 of them. We have 5 left. So my goal over, I hope, the next 3 weeks, before March 1st, 4 weeks, is to get to an agreement and get those bills, those 12 appropriation bills, passed. Those appropriation bills apply to the fiscal year that began back in October. So we're late, and we need to get that done.
All right, real quickly, do you want to talk about the 2024 election? You've already said that you endorse former President Trump. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I want him elected. I spoke with previous secretaries from his cabinet. I spoke to Ryan Zinke, of course, who's now Congressman Zinke from Montana, about his opinion of President Trump and his abilities to help on the issues you and I have been talking about. He's hugely supportive. I also spoke for an hour on this exact issue with David Bernhardt, Secretary Bernhardt, who took Zinke's place after Zinke resigned, and asked him the same questions, which, when it comes to who could do the best job of getting back into the forest and protecting our dams on the Snake River and our water in and across Oregon and the western United States, the answer was unequivocally Donald Trump. And so it's my hope that he gets elected. And I also say it's my hope that we hold on to a majority in the House. I'll just tell you, it's the first time in my life I've been in the majority, and it's a lot more fun than being in the minority.
All right, Congressman, I'm very, very short on time. What would you like to hear from your constituents right now?
Well, I would like to have them explain to me what kind of focus they think I should have in Washington. And there's a lot of national issues, and we focus on those, it seems, every day. But there's also the local issues that I've been hearing about over the past most of the week that are important to everybody here. And people should reach out and say, hey, you have this important job. Here's what we want you working on. So they should let my team in Medford know what they want me to be doing, and then we'll proceed accordingly as best we can, given the challenges in D.C.
All right. Do we have a number for they can call, or an email address? Or Joey, step up to a microphone there somewhere.
So bents.house.gov is the best number to call, and the email. And the number here is probably use the cell number of Joey Miner at my office. It's 541-727-2577. And then the office, if you don't want to call there, which is a good idea, is 541-776-4646. That's 541-776-4646. And that's the office in Medford. So please reach out.
All right. Congressman Cliff Bents, thank you very much for your time. Godspeed, and be strong in Washington for us.
Thank you, Chuck. Really appreciate it.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.